This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Mark Haney. Today it's our monthly gardening program. We're going to focus on urban gardening along with general lawn and garden topics. Joining me are Carriage House Farm Garden Manager Kate Cook, Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, and co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and Director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Huttinger. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Certainly glad to have everybody here. And just as a little reminder, we will talk about anything people want to talk about related to their lawns and gardens. But we're going to start out with our focus today on urban gardening, something that's becoming more and more popular. And I'd like to start with, and maybe Kate, you can help us out. Really, you know, obviously an urban garden, you're dealing with a smaller space based on a suburban garden or at a farm somewhere where you have a lot of room.
Right. Yeah.
But what's different in terms of how you take care of it, how you plant it, what you do?
Well, often urban spaces are a little bit more protected from some things like temperature variation. You know, I live in Northside where we have a lot of fairly dense old brick buildings and they kind of act like a battery for temperature. So when other parts of the city get frost, maybe I won't. And with smaller spaces, you tend to look a lot at containers or raised beds or things where you have a lot more control over your growing medium. So often you can fit a lot more stuff into that space than you would if you, say, like had a half acre and you're doing things in big straight rows. We like planting peppers in 5-gallon buckets at home because you can put them on your steps, you can kind of move them around, and they really like that kind of culture.
Well, how does that work? You just fill the bucket with dirt and then just one or two plants in there? What do you do?
So often we'll drill some holes at the bottom so that water can drain out, and the first layer of stuff you would put in there is we like using the lava rocks, you know, to help with your water movement. And then your growing medium, I like using a mixture of compost and topsoil and maybe some peat moss or some coir in there, which is a coconut fiber. And typically if I'm growing something like a pepper or a tomato or an eggplant, I'll only put one plant per 5-gallon bucket. And so that'll give that plant enough room for its root system. And there's actually varieties of these things that are designed for container growing also. So they're either more compact or maybe they won't get as tall and need as much support. But there's a lot of options for container growing. And honestly, maintenance-wise, you just have to make sure you keep them watered when it gets hot and dry.
Now, you said lava rock on the bottom, but you still drill the holes to drain.
Yes, yes. Okay. Because, you know, if you're just watering all your stuff, you can forget sometimes, and it can still fill that bucket up with water, even with that layer of rock on the bottom. So you need to give the water somewhere to go.
Peter, your thoughts?
Well, one of the big differences with urban gardening and cultivating in larger spaces, like Kate said, is that, you know, they're smaller, but you have to be much more attuned in terms of what you're doing with soil nutrients and really keep an eye on that. If you're growing crops in smaller containers, let's say whether it's a bed that's 4 by 10 feet or a 5-gallon container, you're going to really deplete soil nutrients. And so you need to augment that with good quality compost, particularly animal manure compost or an organic fertilizer, and which is generally, for the most part, is chicken composted chicken manure. And the reason is that, you know, both the nutrients and the organic matter, you know, will dissipate over time. And you'll end up with a kind of a clay brick, you know, because our soil is very heavy. So you really need to be concerned about that. And so in addition to the nutrients, too, it's also really important to add organic matter. You know, you don't want your soil to be, when it's damp, when you pick it up, you don't want it to squish between your fingers. You want it to crumble.
Sarah, your thoughts?
Yeah. So with the topic of urban agriculture and container gardening, it's always a good idea to get your soil tested. A lot of in our urban areas, there may be buildings or that may have been developed or used lead-based materials. And the concern of lead toxicity or other heavy metal toxicities in our native soil. So it's not necessarily the plant is taking that up and it can get into our fruits and vegetables that we consume. It's actually, we can breathe it in. We can move it inside of our house on our shoes or on our tools, things like that. So this can get into the bloodstream of of us. And so we're really concerned about pregnant women and our youth. So we want to just get our soil tested. And so we can do that at the Cooperative Extension Office. We actually send it to Waters Ag, which is in Owensboro, Kentucky, and include it with that heavy metal testing, get a routine soil test, which includes our soil pH and phosphorus and potassium nutrients, so that we know where we start, so we don't put what we don't need, which then therefore can get into our water streams or becomes a pollutant, if you will, into our environment. So start off right, get your soil tested, and it's also, if it's a site and you're not familiar with, look up some historical facts. Was there any house that burnt down? So just know where you're planting, and like Kate said, kind of look up to what trees are in the neighborhood or tall buildings that, you know, may, I guess, interfere with light. Because with vegetables, a lot of them need 6+ hours of direct sunlight. So we need to make sure we take that in consideration as well. And then, of course, wind, I will say. I have a few rooftop gardens that I work with, and our pollinators, our honeybees, don't get up to the rooftop. Oh, so that may be a concern. So we got to take a few other things in consideration when we're talking about urban gardening, urban farming. Compare that to out in a rural part of the county.
And I guess you could have your own beehive up there, too, and that would take care
absolutely,
of that.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, we did a show on lead earlier this week, and I wanted to a couple of people had questions that we said we'll save for today because it was related to gardening. This was from Bennett, who said he wanted to plant a garden adjacent to his Oakley house, and he tested the soil and found 950 parts per million, which is above the guideline of 150 parts per million for residences. And he said 400 parts per million for industrial settings. So he says soil testing was easy, but then what does he do with that if the lead is there? You said it doesn't get into the vegetables?
It doesn't. It's not absorbed through the root system. In fact, it's more in the particles of the soil. So we can move it by our tools, by our shoes, just movement of the soil itself. So it actually is not very mobile in the soil. And I guess one good thing about our clay soils, our native clay soils, is that prohibits the movement of. So again, it doesn't move with water.
What do you do with that if you want to plant in that area and it has some lead issues? Do you just give up on the idea?
Absolutely not. No. So you can provide barriers and different types of barriers. And maybe depending upon your parts per million, you can, for example, call me and I will be glad to go over those recommendations. But maybe, depending upon what you have in your soil, may eliminate or not plant root crops or leafy vegetables, that direct soil to contact with your harvested crop will be there. Unlike tomatoes or things that grow tall, there's a very limited direct contact to our soil. So root crops, of course, that's directly in the soil and that's what we're eating. And of course, leafy greens, where that's direct contact with the soil. So it's really the contact of the soil and the leafy greens. And remember, our hands are in the soil. So if we have fingernails and soil gets underneath mm-hmm. them, or our shoes, and we're bringing things into our kitchen and we don't wash them, that can be a cross contamination. And that can, and if we have any cuts on our fingers, and like myself and most gardeners, we don't wear gloves in the garden. I like to
You're
feel.
You're a true gardener. I can't stand that feel of dirt. I have to have like 12 pairs of gloves on.
You know? So we just need to make sure, you know, we are aware that if we have any cuts, make sure we bandage those up or wear gloves, and we educate the homeowners, the school children, the school groups, anyone involved with the community garden, especially in an urban setting. That we just educate them about that. I don't want to discourage someone, but there are ways that you can continue to garden by raised beds.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, if the soil isn't ideal for planting, then I would say put down some barrier and go up.
Yep.
And do a raised bed. And I would have to say, for especially older or less mobile individuals, that's a great way to make gardening more accessible for them, too, because you could always build your raised bed to be about waist high. So you're not having to crouch or bend over or do those kinds of things and still enjoy the benefits of having a home garden. I know my mom, her back isn't so great anymore, and my dad took the time to do a whole series of raised beds for her, and it's turned out to be a wonderful thing. And then really the problem is just finding what to fill your raised bed with, and that's where we're fortunate that we have, you know, a number of garden centers around that can supply you with those components. And maybe you have a friend with a farm who makes their own compost, and you can start off with some really high-quality product and not necessarily have to worry about problems with the native soil.
Yeah. Well, and also with lead, too, another thing is that it's parts per million. And so one of the things you can do is by dissipating that. And you can do that through adding soil on top. So I think you said his was 900 parts or something like that. I mean, that's extremely high. But generally what you're kind of getting readings of between 350 and 450. And depending, I mean, I've heard some people say 400 parts million is an acceptable level, then down to 150. So you just have to do your research and figure out what your feel is your, you know, is tolerable for you. I think certainly below 200 is definitely what you want to go for, though. But you can, the soil, with lead, it usually settles on top of the soil. So that's why when you have a, do a soil test, they tell you only to dig down 2 inches to get an accurate reading. So if one thing someone can do is remove an inch or two of the soil from their yard, which obviously is a lot of work, or else by adding 4 to 6 inches of soil and deep tilling it in can also dissipate and get the lead level down to an acceptable level. And like in any garden, what you want to do then is just constantly add organic matter and compost on an annual or semi-annual basis to constantly build up so that over time your soil conditions are actually going to improve. Also, when you did your – I don't know, he got the proper guidance when he did his test, but if you do all your tests next to your house, if it had to associate with paint out 4 or 5 feet, it could be a lot higher. So if you're going to vegetable garden, what I would take, you take a random sampling from between 5 to maybe 10 samples in the exact area where you want to garden, and that will probably give you a more accurate result. If you factor in, like if you're just testing your site, your house yard for general purposes, you know, you'd want next to the house part of your sampling. But if you're going a vegetable garden, you know, you could maybe want to concentrate just on where you're gardening. And that'll give you a more accurate reading. But you want to be careful and then test, but the most important thing is retest. And then wait a couple of years and test again.
Keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
We are talking gardens, lawns today. Any questions you have, we'd love to hear from you at 513-419-7100. I encourage you to get those calls in early because we do tend to fill up and then we don't get to all of them. So if you have a question, get it in right now, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition. On 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking today about your lawns and gardens. Joining me are Carriage House Farm Garden Manager, Kate Cook, Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, and co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and Director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Huntinger. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. We got a question in early this morning. Somebody was eager to get their question in saying, I'm planning an herb garden this season and recently read that fennel, cilantro, and dill can all cross-pollinate and negatively affect the taste of all three. How far apart should I plant them to avoid cross-pollination?
Well, I mean, cross-pollination, the pollination takes place by insects going from plant to plant. And so, you know, an insect can travel quite a ways. Yeah. I haven't heard anybody come across that before. I mean, some plants will mature it. You can stagger the planting of those plants, although those are perennial, so they're going to be all blooming and setting pollen at the same time. So I don't know.
I've never heard of that.
So. I haven't either, nor have I experienced it personally. I mean, even though I'm growing in a fairly large space, I still do pretty dense plantings of things. And I've had those three crops in very close proximity to each other. Haven't experienced it myself. And you mentioned that they're perennial. I know that they all like to self-seed. And so they end up being perennial.
Yeah.
And if you're worried about it, maybe try some what we call intercropping, where you're putting a little bit in one space and a little bit maybe across the garden from it. And take notes. I encourage most gardeners to take notes and, you know, to be very observant of what's going on in their garden. And if you find that, well, I had them really close together this year and they didn't taste so good, then the next year you space them out a little bit more and continue to take notes.
Speaking of herbs, I have a question, and this is my own personal problem, and I have definitely a black thumb. But I tried to grow some basil several years in a row now. And I put it in a pot, and the first year I realized I was clipping it wrong. So I learned the right way to clip it so I didn't kill it. YouTube is a wonderful thing.
Yes.
With pictures. But they still tend to grow up very tall and skinny instead of bushy at all. And so I just have this very tall,
kind of scraggly-looking
plant.
Yeah.
What do I do?
Well, to be fair, the last couple summers haven't exactly been the best for basil because basil prefers pretty hot weather. And if our nights are getting down into the 50s or below, that the plants will suffer from that temperature change. And I don't know about you guys, but we've suffered a lot from downy mildew late in the season. But in regards to why your basil isn't bushing out, I say you're still being too timid with your harvesting. You need to really whack that plant back. When I harvest basil, I'll only leave about 3 or 4 inches at the bottom of the plant.
Really?
And just enough for a few sets of good-looking leaves so that the plant can keep generating energy to keep growing. But every time you cut that type of herb back that far, it stimulates it to grow more big, fresh growth. And when the temperature and your water is right, it can bush back up in as little as 2 weeks from cutting it back that far.
All right. I'm going to try again.
And like herbs and like most vegetables, if you're harvesting the foliage for your crop, if you let it go to flower, that's really going to affect your production of the foliage. So definitely you want to cut, prune, back and never let it go to flower because, of course, it will.
Well, it does do that, and I'll cut that off right away, but I should never let it get to that point.
You've let it stretch out way too much.
And you can still whack it back and retrieve it. You can pull it back into vegetative production, but if you understand the life cycle of the plant, its goal is to make seeds. So you want to keep it from doing that as long as you can. So if it tries to flower, you whack it back.
All right. And
slow
so I guess,
it down. Yeah.
I guess even if I don't need basil that night, get it out of there and save it for another day.
Make pesto. Seriously. I mean, we do that a couple times a year with a variety of different herbs. It doesn't just have to be basil. If you ever find yourself with a large quantity of an herb that you like, make a pesto with it. It freezes beautifully, and it will be a really prized thing to have on your dinner table in January.
All right. I got my big question out there. I'm going to let everybody else ask now. Basil settled. Kenneth is calling from Silverton. Our number, by the way, is 419-7100 if you have a question or a comment. Hi, Kenneth. What's your question?
Hi, I'm just wondering how mulch affects the growth of trees. My whole yard is covered in mulch, and I have a couple of trees, and they don't seem to be doing anything.
Well, one of the things is, I mean, you don't want to ever, what they call girdling the tree. You don't want the mulch up against the actual trunk of the tree. You want to rake it down, and whether you talk about the root flare, where the tree trunk meets the ground, it'll gradually kind of flare out. And some tree varieties, even some a little bit of tops of roots might even be visible. You want to get your mulch away from that. Most arborists I've talked to, they said if you're mulching, whether it's the fancy store-bought mulch or wood chips, to actually mulch more around the drip line of the tree. And that's the edge of where the tree extends. And to put that along on the outside is the most beneficial.
And are there particularly good types of mulch, bad types of mulch for trees? Does it matter?
Just want to avoid any use of walnut because there is a natural toxin in walnut, primarily for our vegetable crops that could be toxic to. But I just kind of baseline, just kind of avoid that. But any hardwood mulch, aesthetically, I like pine nuggets, pine mulch. Those tend to have more of an acidic value, so think about that as well. Fresh mulch tends to have high nitrogen, so that could be a little, not beneficial to our nutrients plants of trees and crops, so just know that.
Yeah. Another product, you talk about the pine-based products like pine fines, which is a soil conditioner. It's more expensive, but if you have heavy soil, I mean, that's a good way to build soil around the outside, around the drip line, and also in raised beds for flowers and things like that, not for vegetables, but yeah.
And you never want to mulch too much. So usually about 3 inches. Over time, you never want to add, you're aware of that. I try to avoid any type of rock material or anything like that around a live plant. So, yes, organic type mulches.
Good. Brenda's calling from over the Rhine. Hi, Brenda. What's your question?
Hi. I planted a cherry tree 3 years ago, and it's about 7.5 feet tall now, but it has never bloomed. And I'm wondering if I need to have more than one cherry tree, or there's just something that I don't know.
You don't need more than one cherry tree. Make sure that it is a cherry. Sometimes, depending upon where we buy it, may be mislabeled. So I've done that for sure. Look at the foliage. Make sure that it actually is producing well. It's photosynthesizing correctly. Because if it's not photosynthesizing, then the following production year, growth year, is going to have a negative effect on productivity. So soil sampling, of course, is a good start to see your soil pH. Typically, it likes a 6.5 to 7.2. That's fine. Insects or any other diseases, they do have quite a bit of disease. So if that's not handled correctly and appropriately, that can definitely negatively affect production.
Now, is this a flowering ornamental cherry, or is it a fruitberry?
Sour cherry.
Oh, so it's a – yeah, because they usually – they're the ones that do better in this region, the sweet cherries.
Yeah, they like it here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Do you remember the cultivar's name?
Oh, gee. I probably saved the tag, and I don't have it in my head.
Okay.
Yeah. Montmorency, maybe?
I have one in my front yard. It's in full bloom right now, by the way.
Oh.
So
you're
not,
making her feel bad.
Not trying to rub it in. But, that's interesting.
Something about cold, that if it didn't... cold at the right time or long enough that could affect?
Well, you've been cold. You would have got enough chill hours on it. One of the things that when you're growing fruit and over to Rhine and a couple
of
gardens.
Well, this is actually up the hill. I'm sort of on the edge. I'm on the Liberty Hill my studio where I have more sun.
Okay.
So
but what
I'm
happens
not in the basin.
Yeah, you get like microclimates downtown where it warms up faster. And then what happens, we'll have a cold front come through. So if the buds were starting to form and we got a cold snap, that could have killed the buds and that could have prevented it from freezing. And that's why a lot of times even with things like nectarines and peaches and plums, they say plant that with the north side of your house. And that's a little bit – keeps the tree cooler during the spring. And it'll delay bud set and blossoming, and so that you might be able to fool Mother Nature and get around the late cold snaps. Like
with recent cold snaps.
A lot of people lost their a lot of peaches and nectarines this year.
Brenda, good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking about your lawns and gardens this afternoon. If you have a question, 513-419-7100. Thanks to Penny O'Brien for listening to 91.7 WVXU. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU, talking about your lawns and gardens today. Joining me are Carriage House Farm Garden Manager Kate Cook, Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, and co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and Director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Hunninger. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. And with all the lines full, we're going to go right to the phones again to Candace in Oxford. Hi, Candace. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I live in a second floor apartment, so I was going to attempt to container gardening last year. It failed miserably, partly because I only have east and west facing lights, but the balcony that I was working with was covered. Is there any way to artificially increase my the light that the plants need to grow successfully?
Well, you can, just like we do in greenhouses and such, where you would have a grow light on on your crops to help supplement those daylight hours. But I have to say, it wouldn't be a terribly efficient way to do an outdoor container garden. I might recommend, instead of trying to do the really sun-loving summer crops, that maybe you do pots full of the more tender herbs or salad greens, things that really wouldn't be doing well in full sun in the summer, but would probably flourish in a shadier spot.
Okay. Yeah, are you doing vegetables or are you doing flowers?
Oh, no, I'm doing vegetables.
Vegetables, okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned a grow light, if somebody doesn't know what that is.
Oh, okay. Oh. So they come in all different, what we call shapes and flavors. I mean, like there are LED ones now, but they're incredibly expensive. I've gotten away with just simple fluorescent tubes for my seedlings and such, and you can put that on a timer. If you check out local garden stores, or we even have some hydroponic supply stores in the area, like Worms Way, and I think there's one over in Covington too, where they have some of these grow lights that are designed for smaller contained growing systems. But some of them can be kind of expensive. You would need to do something that's going to be the closest color temperature to daylight to get the best light possible for your plants. But you don't necessarily have to go with a $200 light fixture for your container garden. I'm sure you could get away with maybe a compact fluorescent on a timer.
All right. Yeah. Well, good luck.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for that.
But I just want to repeat what Kate said about the proper selection, select plants that might do a little better with lower light levels. Another thing, too, is if there's whatever color your porch is painted, I mean, if it's a lighter color, it might have a tendency to reflect and bounce around some light.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of keep some simple things in consideration there.
Great. Again, our phone number is 513-419-7100. You can also email questions to talk@wvxu.org or on Facebook and Twitter. Kimberly is calling from Claremont County. Hi, Kimberly. What's your question? I'm fine.
My question is, help me to try to grow some rosemary. Around the holidays, those beautiful little tiny rosemary dishes are in all the stores. I went through three last season. I cannot for the life of me keep them growing. Help.
All right. Rosemary. What do we do to grow rosemary? You helped me with basil. Now we're moving on.
Well, rosemary is fairly hardy, although, to be fair, I have not had good luck myself keeping it over winter, even with covering it and protecting it. So what I tend to do is, as fall is rearing its ugly head, so somewhere in October probably, you would, if you're having your rosemary in the ground during the main grow season, give it a final harvest in October and then dig it up and put it in a pot. And then you can either just take it into your house, or I've had success with maybe putting it in a garage or some other protected area to help it make it through the winter. Because a lot of times these woody herbs will go dormant in the wintertime, but they can get dried out with our winters. The wind is a big factor. And most rosemary isn't hardy when we're getting to close to zero in the wintertime. It's just not going to survive that without some kind of protection.
You can also consider location. If you've got like a plant in front of a south-facing wall, that'll help. Mm-hmm. But like because of the winter, you really want to mulch very heavily the crown of the plant. And this is a situation where I talked about with trees, never put mulch up against the trunk. When you're overwintering or mulching a rosemary, you can sort of semi-even cover the plant. There was a variety that we had got to live a fairly long time. It was called Barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
It has a long branches on it, and the idea is you cut them off for like shish kebabs or something. But I found that particular plant, it seemed to be a little bit more hardy.
Mm-hmm.
And also when you prune those back, it's a lot easier to strip the leaves off them. It's like one long stretch. but really, I mean, the south, we've had a little better luck with them on a south-facing wall. But it's a crapshoot, basically.
Kimberly, good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call. Our number is 513-419-7100. We got an email from Lisa who says, how do you control cucumber beetles and how do you protect berry plants from birds?
Protection. So birds, there is not a pesticide, if you will. So you will have to cover them. Use a row cover, for example, which is a very light white material that goes over. You can use on commercial scale, I've seen, and on homeowner scale, like fishing wire. But the problem is if a little birdie gets stuck in there, you're going to have to help its way and find its way out. So just be mindful of that. And then as far as the other question was cucumber beetles. So you can also use row covers for those if you know the life cycle. So it's always very beneficial to know life cycle, as we talked about earlier, of insects as well. So know that. And, of course, there are organic and systemic and synthetic types of pesticides that you can use, organic soaps that you can use, and then hand pulling too, and then also our beneficial insects. So ladybugs like them. So
create habitat that will attract these beneficial insects is a good one too.
And also check on, when you start seeing the insect, check under the leaves and look for the eggs and squish, you know, destroy the eggs on the bottom part of the leaf is very, and then, or if you're just picking the leaf off, do not compost it, you know, destroy it. But that's that combination. You want to kind of get them before they hatch, but then also think, but hand cultivation. But another thing to kind of consider with the berries, we have a lot of blackberries and bush cherries. Some berries plants are less susceptible or less of less interest, I should say, to birds. We have bush cherries, which is a Nat King cherry. The birds don't seem to want to mess with those. We also have some mulberry trees on our property. If you have one, that's a great decoy. They produce berries over a longer period of time, and I think that's what kind of saves our blackberries from the birds, really. The birds seem to prefer going for the mulberries that are higher up. They feel safe. Cherries, you know, basically consider the top half of the tree is for the birds, and the rest is for you. And then when you're talking about,
they can reach those, right?
Yeah, and the netting, you know, that bird netting is really problematic. You know, you have to rebuy it every year, and you know, birds get caught in it, and that's a problem. Even though maybe you're trying to get rid of them, but my biggest concern about that netting is we've had black snakes get trapped in them. And it's really rough to cut them out. And the black snakes are such an important predator. In terms of for getting mice and voles and different problems in the garden, we really want to look forward to that. So what Sarah said about the Remay is really good, but there's also a product that's a black woven fabric called Shade Cloth. And if you get the one that cuts out only 25% of the light, that makes a pretty good covering for small stands of berries. It still will let some light in, it'll let some moisture in from the rain, and it's heavy enough that it doesn't tangle and snag the way the other products do. And then, Sarah, what's the name of your bulletin, your small fruits bulletin?
Yeah,
you should let people know about that because that's got great information in it.
Yeah, so a new publication that was just printed this year, and it's available at the Campbell County Extension Office, is ID 232. It is Midwest Fruit Pest Management Guide 2016. So they combined this publication this year with small fruits and trees, tree fruit, sorry. And so this is one big guide. So if you need that, it is available PDF online, but it is a 70-plus page publication. So thanks for mentioning that. There are multiple, suggestions, organic.
And people can
options.
Pick those up at your office or just go online and find
either
them
way.
And I believe we have a link online to your office as well at WVXU.org. We're going to go now to Bill in Anderson. Hi, Bill. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah. I have I've lost four trees now to a sapsucker. I didn't believe that's what it was, but from looking it up, I guess it is. How can I control this thing?
Well, if I want to say that we have a little bit of sapsucker issue at the farm with our old apple trees, and the damage is pretty cut and dry as to what's causing it, because it'll look like perforations along the trunks of the trees, because these woodpeckers are so precise with their drilling in there. How to keep them away? I really don't know, because that part of the tree, unless you're going to try to do some kind of trunk wrap. I know that we used to do some kind of crepe paper with Tanglefoot to help control insects, but I don't know if that would really deter a woodpecker at all.
I know that for some pests, there's a systemic, so that means that you apply it to the soil and it's leached through the soil and then taken and absorbed through and translocated throughout the tree. So there are systemic pesticides, but again, we need to identify what insect you're trying to control and making sure that's on the label. So that is definitely one method.
Because the bird's going after the insect.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not the tree that they're interested in.
No.
Right?
No.
Oh, really? The sap sucker? I thought they ate the sap from the tree or something like that.
They do enjoy the sap treat, but they're really going after insects.
Good luck, Bill.
Yeah, good luck. Right, keep you. Us posted.
Thank you so much. Our phone number is 513-419-7100, or you can email us, talk@wvxu.org. Carol's calling from Mainville. Hi, Carol. What's your question?
Hi. How you guys doing today?
Good.
I have three Canadian cherry trees in my yard, and over the past few years, we've noticed black knot on them. We've been pretty lucky to cut it out each spring, but this year, the trees are just devastated. I fear we have to cut them down and replant something, although this is the year they're finally filling out and looking beautiful, but all the new growth happens on the outside of the black knot, and then when we cut that out, it takes away like the 6 to 8 inches of new growth we have. So do you have any suggestions on how to, you know, get rid of that virus, black knot?
So that's where you're going to have to refer to ID 232. You know, it's very problematic, and those are very susceptible to the black knot, of course. It's very
What is black knot? I've not heard of it.
It's a disease, and it really is like a black knot right on the stem of the tree, and then it can show symptoms on the fruit itself.
All of our branches, they're just like gnarly, like old lady knuckles. Not to be mean, but they just get all twisted and gross, and
If you know that, you really have to take a symptomatic approach and really do preventative care. So reach out to me, and I will send you this guide, because it's not something that's very, you know, cut and dry. It's a very strict spray schedule. So I can't just recommend one thing and it's going to cure everything. So again, reach out to me in Campbell County Extension.
Is that for anybody? Do you have to live in Campbell County to...
No, and I can send you the link, stop in. I'll give it to you, or I can mail you part of that. I may not mail the whole publication to you, but I'll, you know, copy and give you what you need. So, yeah, please let me know, because we definitely want to manage this so you don't cut it down, and I don't want you to be spraying something incorrectly.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah. Another thing when selecting – go ahead.
I just didn't know where to find that publication. I didn't know if do I get that information off the air for, like, the –
You can go to our website at WVXU.org for a link to Sarah's website. And then she also has, we also have information there. You can just contact Sarah, and then she said she'd mail that out to you.
Yep. Okay. My email's on our website. And again, you can just Google ID 232. Or if you have any problems finding that, just let me know, please.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for your call. Peter?
Well, I think another thing, there's a big interest now in terms of people planting fruit trees and shrubs in their yards. And unfortunately, a lot of the plants that are made available through local nurseries and stuff really aren't well suited for our area.
So true.
So one of the things you want to make sure, like, there's been a big problem with fire blight. And there's no tree that's immune to fire blight. But there are varieties of apples, say like Enterprise, that are less susceptible to fire blight. So when you select your nursery stock, it's really important to do some research. I know OSU Extension, Ohio State University Extension, has also a small fruit and fruit tree bulletin, and they have some recommended varieties. And I believe UK Extension also has some recommended varieties. If you know people who have trees that are successful and healthy, you know, find out what the variety is. But and then another thing is to consider is that when you pick apple, pear, peach, all these trees need a spray cycle, and it can be done totally organically. But there's you do what's called a dormant spray before they break. Leave dormancy in the early spring, and then you follow with a lighter version of that, which is called a summer spray, after the fruit is formed on the tree. And it's basically a horticultural oil, and that'll smother a lot of insects. But you have to at least do that. And also consider the size of the tree. Dwarf tree is a small tree that's easy for a homeowner to take care of and spray and prune. A semi-dwarf is pushing it because a semi-dwarf can go 20, 24 feet. And a standard, I just don't recommend within city limits. There's some reasons to do standards for propagation and longevity of species, but they're just very difficult for a homeowner to manage.
Again, our number is 513-419-7100. Marty's calling from Florence. Hi, Marty. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a good-sized bald cypress tree, 25, 30-foot tall, sun very well, but the root system's quite extensive, and they come to the surface, and then they have these big nodules. And other than just putting a lot of dirt off and raising the whole yard, there's becoming an issue for the lawn service and my neighbors cutting the lawn.
Okay, so this is a bald cypress, right?
Yeah, bald cypress tree.
Okay, so knowing a little history about this tree, it likes water.
Yes.
And so those little what we call knees that are coming up in your lawn,
yes,
that's a way for the tree to breathe, and that's naturally what it does. So you adding mulch or other materials on top of it, it's just going to keep pushing those knees closer and closer. So I would not recommend that. It may not have been the best tree for the site. So, you know, unfortunately, every time you mow and you're nicking those knees,
yeah,
with you're just creating damage, which is an entryway for disease and insects. So just be very cautious. Maybe you could mulch around to the drip line, as we were discussing earlier, but you're fighting the natural habitat, the natural growth of this tree. So I definitely am not encouraging you to take it down, but maybe understanding its natural growth habit and need in the environment.
Yeah, it's a good... It's done very well. It's 30 foot tall, so I don't really want to take it down.
Yes.
And my neighbor enjoys it, too. It's just that it's becoming an issue.
Yeah, so that's exactly what it's doing, what it's supposed to do. So, you know, I understand that, you know, in your lawn, it's going to maybe take up some of the area that you don't want it to, but it's doing exactly what it's to do, and there's nothing you can do about it. So,
okay,
you know, just enjoy the beauty of that tree because it's on my favorite list.
Well, yeah, right now it's just about ready to look good. So,
yeah.
All right, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Marty. We had an email question from someone asking if you know of any community gardens close to downtown that people can get involved in.
Well, I would recommend there's quite a few, actually. The one thing I would recommend is Civic Garden Center, to give them a call, because I know there's like three or four gardens that Greg Potter manages through that organization. The Turner Farm Community Garden Program, we have gardens in the East End, which is fairly close to downtown. But you can contact Joshua Jones, our garden manager down at the East End, if you're in that towards that direction.
And on the Kentucky side, you know, in Campbell County, we definitely have quite a few of them. We cooperate with, you know, churches, Brighton Center, for example.
That's in Newport.
That's in Newport. I know that Kenton County has a few of them, downtown Covington. So, you know, there's a wonderful one at the in Melbourne, Kentucky, which is in Campbell County. All that produce is harvested and given to the free store, which all that produce goes to those families in need. So if you're interested in, you know, Campbell County in particular, again, give me a call and I can give you resources on that. So,
and we also have a link to the Civic Garden Center on our website as well, wvxu.org. Patrick emailed and says, are we due for cicadas this year, and how does he care for plants? They're in different stages. Some have sprouted and some have not.
Well, we will always have the annual cicadas.
Yeah. I thought it was a big year. It was supposed to be the big year this year.
It's northeast.
Northeast?
Yeah, more northeast. Cincinnati proper isn't supposed to get hit this year, but it's coming. Yes.
Yeah. So...
All right, and we go now to Stephen in Pleasant Ridge. Hi, Stephen. What's your question?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Certainly. Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. My question is, I've been gardening for years now in my neighborhood, and I have above ground beds. I kind of did this 4-foot garden thing back in the 80s. But anyway, my question is, how do I keep squirrels eating all my potatoes?
Hate the squirrels.
I hate them. But I've gone to the point that I barricade pretty much tomato plants with bird netting, and that it just detracts really from the whole experience trying to garden.
So what do you do with squirrels, folks?
Throw it on the ground.
Well, my experience with squirrels and like chipmunks, especially snitching tomatoes specifically, is I've noticed that happens more when we're in our really hot, dry days. And more often than not, they're just thirsty. So one thing you can do that's a really simple potential fix is to put out a squirrel waterer like you would a bird bath and just give them a water source other than your ripening tomatoes. And I think apart from that, the only way you're really going to keep them off of there is a physical barrier of some sort.
Now, if you put water out, what about the fear of mosquitoes? Do you have to just dump that water regularly?
Yeah.
And I find that it's not difficult to maintain, especially if you're trying to attract other more attractive wildlife to your yard. If it's worth it having the tomatoes for yourself versus having two bites and then discard it.
And when they do take that one bite, you know, it's still edible, so maybe just cut that off and, you know.
Oh, you're very brave.
Yeah.
That sounds a little creepy to me, but that's good.
I totally have done it. So
make a sauce.
Make a sauce out of it. Yeah. But they're typically, like, you know, Kate said, they're taking a drink of water out of that fruit. So,
Well, the garden downtown on Ezra Charles, we had a real problem with squirrels there because there were some English walnut trees. So they had a really nice support system. So, but I did notice one year I would grow usually an heirloom tomato, a hybrid tomato, and a cherry tomato. And I was noticing that they were decimating the hybrid and the heirloom tomatoes but didn't touch the cherry. And it was a sun gold cherry. And so the next year we grew three different varieties of cherry tomatoes and we experienced no loss. Either that or there were so many cherry tomatoes, they just took the whole cherry and ran off with it. But
right,
at one point, we had a huge yield. So I would experiment, you know, try growing a cherry tomato and see if the squirrels are going after that. I've never seen any other support material or research on it, but my practical experience down at the Center for Chemical Addictions Treatment Garden was that, in fact, you know, they really didn't mess with the cherry ones for some reason.
I'm wondering if they key on the red, too, so maybe growing an orange or a yellow.
Well, we did. The next year I did a red, a black, and an orange.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a sun gold.
And they stayed away from all of them.
Yeah, and they stayed away from all three because I was curious about the same thing, whether it was just the color.
And also, like Peter mentioned, habitat. So if you're planting around a mature a mature tree that they're, you know, living or thriving in, maybe
that's the highway.
That's the highway. Yeah. So I know, like in Fort Thomas over at the VA, tons of beautiful mature trees, and we have a lot of squirrels. But at our office, we don't have that many mature trees around our vegetable garden. We tend not to have that. We have mice problem. But you know,
one thing or another. Then you need the black snakes, right?
And we do. Steven. So donate some black snakes to our office.
And Stephen, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. Real quick.
I wanted to say that if your problem is like a chipmunk versus a squirrel, they don't care about – they will go after the cherry tomatoes. I have caught many a small one with just like the cheek pouches.
We got one last email from Nicole, who just moved into a new home with existing beds. She wants to know if she should wait and see what was planted there already or go ahead and plant right now, and what should she start with?
Well, if it's vegetables, if there's anything perennial, like say, you know, say planted fall planted garlic or there's an asparagus, whatever perennial would be coming up.
Should be up by now, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in terms of vegetables.
So she can get started. We're out of time. I hate to say it. Thank you so much for being here. As always, my favorite show to fill in for, The Gardening Show, even though I have a black thumb. Thanks so much. Well, it's been the monthly Lawn and Garden Show this afternoon. My guests were Carriage House Farm Garden Manager Kate Cook, Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, and co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and Director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, Peter Huttinger.